Thank you, John, very much for that warm welcome. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure and an honour to be here. In the grand sweep of the wider history of our islands, ours is a strange debate this evening for at least a pair of reasons. Firstly, the life of the mine should have little or nothing to do with customs unions, for that is what the European Union in its various forms since 1952 has been and will remain. For free trade comes no freer than the global intellectual trade in ideas and research. A free trade of the mind is something we can all sign up to wherever we stand on the great European debate. It's currently gnawing at the vitals of the British body politic. The free trade of the mind should never be cabined or confined by anyone, be they politician, bureaucrat or priest. There can be no tariff on thought. It is borderless. Secondly, the United Kingdom was a very considerable player in the world when it came to research, science and technology and the arts and humanities before we joined what was then the European Economic Community in January 1973, and it will remain so in 2018 if next month's referendum requires the UK to leave the EU and the timetable for ejection prescribed by the Lisbon Treaty is adhered to. As a country, we have always thought heavier than our weight in the world, since, I suppose, at least the 17th century, and I'm confident that we will continue to do so, whatever the British people reveal as their collective wisdom, when the voting result is announced early in the morning of Friday the 24th of June in Manchester. The reasons for our global prowess in the Little Grey Cells department, our cultural world service, as Melvyn Bragg rather nicely describes it, are multiple. And I'm pleased to say that the British Academy will soon be mounting a study of the ingredients of this particular prowess with the encouragement of the House of Lords Select Committee on Science and Technology. Now, all that said, research needs fructifying institutions and funding streams to irrigate the life of the mind, both at the national and the international levels. And it's my belief that our 43-year membership of the European Community in its various forms has, on balance, been a positive aid to this end. Of course, it's impossible to demonstrate such an assertion. After all, in January 1973, we couldn't have set up a control group of universities and research labs that would not be eligible for EEC largesse any more than we could have set aside, say, Warwickshire from EEC membership to see how they flourished in a world without Europe. Victor Rothschild always thought Warwickshire would be the ideal control group for any pilot scheme the government wanted, because it had the mixture of city, town, rural, all that, tourism. So I choose Warwickshire in tribute to the great Victor. But impossible to do, of course. As was NATO. You couldn't have left Denmark out of NATO to see if Stalin really was the bastard we thought he was. It's not the way these things work. Now, from the evidence sessions of the Lords Committee in pursuit of its inquiry into EU membership and the UK science, I acquired impressions that had not dawned on me before. For example, it strikes me that this aspect of our 43-year-old relationship with what a diplomatic friend of mine calls this great experiment in soft power under the shelter of the United States nuclear umbrella has been the least jagged or raw of perhaps all the other linkages, which taken together amount to a formidable emotional deficit that the Brits have with the European Community, which will endure even if we vote to remain. It's partly, of course, that we didn't invent it. I mean, most people at the time were quite happy with the British Empire because it was wholly owned and it was our sort of thing. And we could convince ourselves with some justification that we invented NATO. Very big part in it, to say the least, Ernest Bevin and all that. But the coal and steel community in the early 1950s, when you think about it, came out not from a UK view of the world, but out of the minds of clever Catholic left-wing French bureaucrats. Clever, Catholic, left-wing Frenchman. And most Brits have problems with at least three of the five. I don't, as it happens, partly because I'm a papist, but that's not the real reason. Now, if the UK had invented post-war European integration, it would be so very different. All run by a tiny secretariat from a small office located in an area of high unemployment, producing perhaps three letters a year, saying, would you mind awfully, but only if you've got time, doing a little bit more on free trade here and here and here. We're not a directives people, are we? That's the problem. If we'd shaped the community, there would probably have been no science or R&D element in it at all. But there it is, it exists, and it matters. It is, as the Select Committee reported, a major component of the UK's membership of the EU. Nearly one-fifth, 18.3%, of EU funding to the UK is spent on research and development. As that great man Michael Caine might have put it, not many people know that. They really don't. The science and the R&D element is not and will not become a turn factor in the great European debate. There's time, but it won't, despite the best efforts of the Select Committee. In fact, it is barely a squeak amidst the great cacophony of claim and counterclaim that assaults us. There would, I believe, be a loss to the UK on this front if we leave. It was put to the committee that the EU funding stream is the equivalent of having an extra research council in the UK. We might also lose part of the human flow into and out of our labs that the free movement of people within the EU permits in an era where ever more the prizes go to the international and the collaborative. Switzerland doesn't offer a happy exemplar. Among the witnesses we heard, Professor Siegfried Rusfurm, Chief Technology Officer of Siemens, and Professor Philippe Morion, Vice-Rector for Research and International Relations at the University of Lausanne, were especially eloquent about this. Switzerland, which Professor Morion quite rightly described as a science jewel as a country, quite rightly, prides its science base and prides itself, as we do, in thinking heavier than its weight in the world. But it's not an exact guide of how UK scientific and R&D life might be if we leave. It can't be. We're very different countries, however you slice it. But how Switzerland has fared as an associated country within the EU is instructive. Along with a dozen other non-EU countries, it participates in the EU framework programme funding schemes and puts money into the EU budget. But such countries lack the level of influence in decision-making processes and within the advisory panels that the EU members enjoy. They do, however, benefit from freedom of movement of people. But when in 2014 Switzerland narrowly voted to restrict freedom of movement in a referendum, it was suspended from access to what was then called the EU's Horizon 2020 programme, which plainly hurt it, plainly hurt it. Professor Morion, in his evidence to the Select Committee, was eloquent on the limits to the Swiss position. This is what he said. When we became an associate, it was much, much easier, of course, but we're still not sitting at the decision table or on the consultative committees where the decisions are made. We have a number of ways to interact, such as through university associations. We are still in the corridor, that's the phrase, we are still in the corridor, but at least we are part of the whole programme. The implication of this, ladies and gentlemen, I think, is that if the UK leaves it, it too will become a corridor nation. And we never want to be a corridor nation. We want to play on every playing field in the world. We belong to more international organisations as a country than anybody else because of the nature of our history and our global reach, territorial in the past, in other ways now. 70 plus international organisations. We are not a corridor nation and never will be. We might be prouder, sturdier, and more independent if we depart from the EU, but we'll very likely be poorer in terms of science and R&D funding if we do so. There are, however, a number of unsatisfactory elements within the existing scientific relationship which the Select Committee inquiry illuminated. It is not all an ode to joy in tune with the EU's Beethovenian hymn. Harmonisation and EU regulations can bite into that prime principle of intellectual free trade with which I began. For example, the Select Committee concluded that in the area of genetic modification and clinical trials, UK business and research were placed at a disadvantage compared to non-EU competitors because of EU regulations. And on the business front, compared to the universities, UK companies have not proved adept at siphoning off EU science and R&D funding. Business, unlike the universities and the learned societies, was reluctant to give evidence to our Select Committee, which is a pity and a bit of a mystery to me. We picked up an impression that excessive EU bureaucracy and a low level of support from Her Majesty's government, especially compared to Germany, were at work here as well, plus the fact that the structural EU funding tends to go to the poorer EU members rather than those which run the more mature economies. So there is a can-do better theme within the wider picture of our relationship with the EU on the science and R&D front. Perhaps a genuine possibility lurks here. Perhaps. If we remain, how about the UK government crafting an initiative on this very terrain? More money for science and R&D as a proportion of the EU budget, perhaps. An attack on bureaucracy. A serious look at those regulations that restrict research in certain areas. Such an initiative would it not, have an attractive air of novelty, even of shock about it? Because to adapt that most fertile but not scientific of minds, P.G. Wodehouse, for many years now, if you work in the Commission, it's always been easy to distinguish between a ray of sunshine and a British Prime Minister bearing a grievance. Final thought. Obvious one, but important nonetheless. Towards the end of the Second World War, the great Labour politician and orator Nye Bevan took on the gloomsayers about Britain's post-war economic prospects. This island, he said, I shouldn't try and imitate his voice because it's impossible. This island, he said, is almost made of coal and surrounded by fish. In other words, how can we be poor? That's what he was saying. Well, we know what happened to our cod and to our great industry based on black gold. For in modern Nye Bevan terms, our one fixed national capital asset is our collective cluster of little grey cells. We must nurture them, feed them with both love and money, and bring in the best from the four corners of the earth to stimulate them. The subject of our debate this evening really matters. Thank you very much.